Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today, March 24th, 2011. And I don't know if you know this, probably not too many of you, judging from the colors of our outfits. Today is National Orange Day. Of course, B, Dean of University College, knew that. I got the memo too late last night, and my orange blouse was in the wash. But anyway, we're celebrating the 141st anniversary of Syracuse University. Ah, Tony has on his SU tie, our police chief here. Thank you. It is also tonight, SU Orange Women will be playing in the third round of the WNIT. Yay! So, 7 p.m. at the Dome. Support them against Eastern Michigan, but doesn't matter. Great. Anyway, it is my pleasure today. I am so happy that we have the State Attorney General with us today. It's like overwhelming. Yesterday, the governor in Syracuse. Today, the Attorney General. That's great. I want to thank TMR member Joe Rossi very much for helping to orchestrate today's visit from the AG. And actually, it is Joe who's going to introduce our guest speaker today. So if he's ready, we will get right to it. After the remarks, I know we have some questions, and we'll also be taking some questions from the audience if there's time. So we'll do that.
Good morning. Good morning. All right. It is my privilege to introduce Attorney General Schneiderman this morning. First, allow me to recognize some of the guests today from the Governor's Office, Dan Young, Onondaga County Democratic Chair, Madam Chair Vita DeMarkey, Syracuse Common Counselor Pam Hunter, the Dean, B. Gonzalez, John Murad, SUNY Trustee, Syracuse Common Counselor Lance Denno, Chris Wiles, who actually worked for the first Attorney General, so it's good that he's here. He's the Assistant Attorney General. Ed Thompson, the Syracuse Attorney General in charge. Scott Butler from Senator Valesky's office. Colleen Deacon from Senator Gillibrand's office. County Legislator Linda Irvin. And my personal hero, Marty Mack, is here, so that's pretty great to have him. Eric Schneiderman was elected the 65th Attorney General of the state of New York in November 2010. Attorney General Schneiderman is the highest-ranking law enforcement officer for the state, responsible for representing New York and its residents in legal matters. Attorney General Schneiderman has established restoring the public's faith in its public and private sector institutions as key priorities for the Attorney General's office by focusing on areas including public integrity, economic justice, social justice, and environmental protection. As the state's top law enforcement officer, Attorney General Schneiderman brings with him a wealth of experience in both the public and private sectors. Before becoming Attorney General, Attorney General Schneiderman served in the New York State Senate as a leading reformer and was praised by numerous editorial pages and good government organizations as a rare leader in Albany who stood up to leaders of both parties to reform government and get results for New Yorkers. The Attorney General previously spent 15 years in the private practice as an attorney and later as a partner at the firm Kirkpatrick and Lockhart, where he handled complex litigation. He was also a public interest lawyer for many years. Attorney General Schneiderman is also a former deputy sheriff of the Berkshire County, Massachusetts. Previous New York Attorney Generals have been called the Sheriff of Wall Street and Sheriff of State Street. This AG was actually a sheriff. Attorney General Schneiderman graduated from Amherst College and Harvard Law School with honors. He's a proud father of a daughter, Catherine. Ladies and gentlemen, the Attorney General of the State of New York, Eric Schneiderman.
Wow, thank you very much. Good morning. Thank you to Sandra and to Joe for the welcome. Thanks to all of you for getting up on a cold morning and coming out to join us. It's great to be back in Central New York, a place I've actually spent a fair amount of time. It's always been good to me and to see some old friends here, Walt and Joan Christensen. And I'm very, very pleased to be joined by the fellow who supervises all of my regional offices around the state, Marty Mack, the Executive Deputy Attorney General. Who I'm working very closely with to make sure that we have this operation as integrated as we possibly can have. We are one office, and with the technology that exists today, I have a strong commitment to being out in the regions, to visiting, to working with the lawyers there, to making sure that we can run a 21st century law firm. And in a 21st century law firm, you don't have to be in the same building to work on the same case. You know, a lawyer in Syracuse can do a part of a brief that's being submitted in Buffalo, and I'm also helped out by lawyers in Binghamton and in New York City. So we are trying to bring our office up to date. We're trying to become the best public law firm in the United States. I have a lot of experience in the private sector, and I'm trying to take a slightly different approach to the project. I have brought in, for the first time in the history of the Attorney General's Office, a chief operating officer, someone whose experience is in management. This is someone who spent quite a few years as a partner in a big law firm. I am well aware of the fact that lawyers all fancy themselves great managers. In fact, few are. So my friends who went off into management consulting have a lot to teach us, and we're going to use the best systems, the best techniques, the best technology. And our goal is to give you all the best representation you possibly can have from the Attorney General's office. It's great to be here at the Thursday morning roundtable, and I know I don't have any particularly big announcements other than the investigation we've taken into refereeing in the NCAA, which I can't comment on anymore because it's at a very intensive stage of development. But the look, the experience of becoming Attorney General has been wonderful. I learn a lot every day, which is what I like. I like, you know, always trying things I don't know and trying things that push me. But as I travel around the state, and this is a tremendously diverse state. New York is just an extraordinary, beautiful state, rich with all sorts of different communities from one end to the other. As I travel around the state, I do see the same thing I saw as I traveled around the state for 18 months or so as a candidate, that in spite of the diversity of our state, there are these two consistent themes that I hear over and over again. New Yorkers have lost confidence in the fundamental institutions of our public sector, and New Yorkers have lost confidence in a lot of the big institutions of the private sector. There is a sense of disconnection and disregard for fundamental institutions that were really important to me growing up and that I think are essential for all of us to go forward together and to turn New York back around into the great state and national leader that it once was and will be again. This is a state whose policies really led the nation for decades. We're memorializing on Friday the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. And I'm writing something about that, something that looms very strong in the lives of those of us whose families were among the immigrant workers who worked in those kinds of situations. But it also is emblematic of a time when New York seized on this tragedy to create worker safety rules, public safety rules, worker protection laws that were the model for the country. A lot of the things that happened in the New Deal were first modeled by the government of the state of New York, and some of the people who Roosevelt took with him to Washington, like Francis Perkins, started their work developing reforms in the state of New York. That is the state that I want to leave to my children. I don't want to just trail along. I want to be in leadership, trying new things, working harder to make our state and our country more just, more equitable, more profitable, and just a better place to live. So I've been struck by this loss of confidence in the institutions that were so critical to leading the nation during those decades, and I've been very, very direct with the folks who work for me. Our first priority in hard economic times, when people don't believe in the institutions that are essential to move us forward out of the hard economic times, is to restore public confidence. I believe in the public sector as a force for good. And those of us who believe in the public sector as a force for good have to be the harshest critics of waste, fraud, and corruption in the public sector. And this is something I tell my more liberal colleagues. And until they get that, until we all get that, we're not going to restore the public's confidence in the government. I mean, the governor and I talk about this because we were campaigning during the same period. You go around the state and you talk to people about Albany and they literally shake their heads. It's just, you know, it's unacceptable, and it's something we have to address, and there's no argument that will make it go away. What will make it go away is action. So that's why when I was in the legislature I worked for and I'm working now on trying to pass comprehensive ethics reform, I think we're closer than we've been in many years to accomplishing not every goal, but to really opening the system up so you can understand where the money is moving, how much your legislators are being paid. You can see all the documents that are being submitted to the government. That's why I started practicing up being a prosecutor even before I got into this office when I argued to set up and then chaired the committee that expelled Senator Hiram Monsarrat, the first time in modern history that we have expelled a corrupt member of the state legislature. Public service is a trust, and I believe very strongly in that, and I'm continuing my work in the areas of public integrity, and I will be expanding those activities. And a particular interest to people here, we are going to be trying to expand what we're doing to help local governments more who have trouble, just because of the lack of resources, policing themselves. My first major initiative was something called the Taxpayer Protection Unit, which is based on the fact that as of last September, New York has the strongest False Claims Act in the country. A False Claims Act is something where you can come in as a whistleblower, say, hey, you know what, the waste hauler, they say they're taking 100 tons and they're actually taking 50 tons. They're submitting false invoices to the county. The whistleblower gets a reward, there are provisions to protect the whistleblower, and I can bring an action to get triple damages and civil penalties against anyone who rips the state off for anything. If a public official submits forms to get reimbursement and some of them are false, we can go after them. This is modeled on the great success of the Federal Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. And we have a Medicaid Fraud Control Unit in our office as well, which has accomplished great things. And the feds, who spend a lot of money on Medicaid, have set these up all across the country. I'm particularly proud of our unit. We've recovered millions of taxpayer dollars, hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars in the last few years, and I'm in the process of expanding that. But it occurred to me that there are many, many more billions of dollars that are not Medicaid funds that are used in other government contracts. The state government in New York, we spend tens of billions of dollars a year on road contractors, on people who provide food services to schools, on people who provide preservation services in the parks. Every one of those contracts has to be scrutinized. I'm confident that if we're going to restore public confidence in the government, we have to go after this from the top and from the bottom. We have to go after corrupt officials at the top. But we also have to make sure everyone knows their taxpayer dollars are being well spent and there aren't contractors ripping them off. So that was our first major initiative. We're the first time in the history of New York State we've had a dedicated group of lawyers dedicated to going after that level of corruption in the government. It is also something local governments can do. So I've been talking to the State Bar Association about training lawyers who can help local governments bring similar actions. It's hard to understand also, I think, for a lot of folks back where I come from in New York City, the degree of public anger at what's happened in the financial services industry. And it's fascinating. The further I get away from Manhattan, the more I hear about that anger. It was one of my colleagues, another attorney general, said, our people went from savers to investors. And then they and their communities and their pension funds got into the market, and they came away thinking Wall Street was a rigged casino. What a horrible thing for so many Americans to have felt. So the restoration of confidence in the private sector is the second big mandate for the people in my office. I spent many more years in private practice than I have in public service. I was a partner in a big law firm during the 80s and the 90s, and I saw the guys involved in high-yield bonds or junk bonds come and go, and I saw the SNL crisis come and go and was involved in those things. I understand how the industry works. But at some point over the course of the last 5 or 6 years, the market got broken. Things went wrong in a way that they hadn't gone wrong, frankly, since the 1920s. And it's something that we are committed to addressing, and we're committed to making sure that everyone in this country, because New York is the financial center of the country, regains confidence in our market's abilities to treat them fairly. that when you get something that has a AAA rating, that's not, as the rating agencies are now claiming, just a matter of opinion. That's their defense now, and all these charges where then people bought all this AAA-rated stuff that turned out not to be so good. Oh, we're protected by our First Amendment rights. That's a matter of opinion. Well, you know, that's not what the investors thought. Issues like that have to be addressed, and there's a lot of pressure coming on now from a lot of the conservatives and some short-sighted business interests. And I emphasize that because there are a lot of people in the business community understand that we have to demonstrate that we can police bad actors so good actors can flourish. There's a lot of pressure coming saying, well, let's just clean this up, you know, and move along. Let the folks who got the money keep the money. Sorry about your pension fund. Sorry that, you know, a lot of the people in your community are having your homes foreclosed. This is something we will address. We are expanding our activities in this area. I'm a part of a 50-state investigation by other attorneys general, which was kind of languishing, frankly, when I took over. We're now in negotiations with the banks, but my demand to my colleagues is I'm not signing off and giving a general release to anyone in the financial services sector unless we have a real investigation and understand who did what. So, again, this is not a matter, either in terms of policing the public sector or policing the private sector, of me being out to get somebody. You know, there's a certain... It's interesting, and people are, as I travel around and meet with other attorneys general, we had a big conference of the National Attorney General Association in Washington a few weeks ago. People are scared of the New York State Attorney General. You know, it's sort of like, following Henry Kissinger as Secretary of State when he said, you know, they have to believe you're crazy enough to bomb them into the Stone Age or you can't be effective. So I'm actually a pretty easygoing guy. But I am very passionate about the fact that I believe in this state. I believe in our business community. I believe that the markets, when they operate properly, are just one of the great inventions and institutions in the history of the world. And I've seen a lot of my friends do well there. I've seen a lot of innovators get capital and come up with great ideas. I believe that the government of New York State, whether it has to do with the visionaries who created the Erie Canal, our system of mass transit, the unbelievable work on the watershed that feeds the greatest metropolitan area in the world with fresh, clean drinking water, the network of public colleges and universities. This is a state that has shown public-private partnership. The public sector weighing in ways that help boost the private sector can accomplish great things. I want to restore that confidence. I want to restore that confidence with regard to both the state government, local governments, and the institutions of the private sector. So, we've had a lot of successes so far, and I have a long list of them, which I'm not going to share with you. Whenever I give a speech like this, I get lists. But a couple of them I do want to note. In hard economic times, people, particularly scammers, take advantage of different things. We have been very vigilant on the issue of debt collection services, debt modification services. People who tell you they're going to fix your mortgages. 2 weeks ago, we won a settlement, very substantial settlement from a company that fraudulently offered debt settlement services in Western New York. We have gone after people who have been trying to take advantage of folks caught up in the confusion of the federal immigration laws. It's a huge problem right now, as you can imagine. You know, there's a lot of pressure now on immigrant communities. We have huge immigrant communities in New York State. We have probably 14 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. We busted people, and you want to talk about, I've seen a lot of despicable things. I worked in a prison for 2 years, and I spent 12 years in the state senate. So I've seen a lot of despicable things. But after the Haitian earthquake, this group got together and they said, we're going to trick all the Haitians who think they can now get temporary protective status and take their money and rip them off. How low is that, right? So we busted them. We shut that down. We're trying to be sensitive to the fact that in these kinds of economic times, different scams have developed. We're trying to stay one step ahead of those who would abuse the people of the state of New York. The job of Attorney General is also a regulatory job. And this has affected my thinking a lot as I talk to my friends and people I went to college and law school with. We have vast authority regulating not-for-profits in the state, which is between a sixth and a fifth of the economy of the state of New York. Our Real Estate Finance Bureau deals with offering plans on real estate. We have a securities registration division. So In addition to having as a goal of my office creating the best public law firm in the country, the second goal is that whenever we can, I want the lawyers in my office to understand that you're supposed to work to make New York as competitive as it can possibly be in the global economy. We're supposed to help New York businesses be competitive. You don't just get points. I mean, historically, the office has grown to the point that the people who are at the top of the organizational chart tend to all be fraud prosecutors. So the people who are supervising the folks who are trying to work on real estate plans or help not-for-profits are fraud prosecutors. What do you think gets rewarded by your boss, the fraud prosecutor? Finding fraud. So our message is, in my office, you get points for helping the good guys do their deals more efficiently, as well as for catching bad guys who are doing something they shouldn't be doing. And then the third goal, which is tremendously important to me and fits in with the opening part of my remarks, is that I am a true believer in the American vision of equal justice under law. And I believe that the mission of this country, and we may have strayed off track from time to time, is ever greater justice, ever greater equality, ever greater access for all Americans to equal justice under law. It strikes me that at lawyers and people who work to reform the laws, there are times when, you know, I'm going to be enforcing existing laws. There are times when I'm going to be advocating to reform the laws because, you know, as in Albany, there's a lot of stuff that's legal that shouldn't be legal. And that was also the case, I think, during the financial meltdown. But our direction and our focus always has to be forward. And I've held out to lawyers in my office as a role model for this, a guy who's a personal hero of mine. He went also to Amherst College and Harvard Law School. But his name is Charles Hamilton Houston. And for lawyers seeking to better society, he's as good a model as you could possibly have. He was a great lawyer. He was the first dean of Howard Law School, or vice dean, and got the accreditation for Howard. Very active in the African American community in Washington, D.C. And then did something really remarkable. In 1934, he sat down and wrote a memo to the NAACP. It said essentially, the law of the United States is separate but equal. Segregation is legal in the United States today. You know, people very romanticize the civil rights movement and think, God, I wish I had been there. Well, we wish you had been there in 1964. Believe me, you don't wish you had been there in 1934. That was a tough, tough situation. He wrote a memo that said, this is going to take us decades, but here's how we're going to overturn the Supreme Court's decision in Plessy v. Ferguson that said separate but equal is okay. Here's how we're going to end all the Jim Crow laws in the country. And he developed a very sophisticated plan to change public awareness, to bring cases strategically. And they gave him the times have changed. They gave him funding to accomplish this goal of $10,000. And over the next few decades, they did it. He trained the great lawyers that, when I was young, we learned, you know, had brought this about. William Hasty, Robert Carter, a young man named Thurgood Marshall, who was his protege, who he trained. And the most important thing for the lawyers I speak to about Houston is, he never lived to see Brown v. Board of Education overturn Plessy v. Ferguson and establish the right to equal justice under law. He never lived to see the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But he had the confidence in this nation, and he had the confidence in the rule of law, that if we work hard and we stay true to our principles, we can accomplish great things. Now, I'm not sure that I'm going to see the fruits of all of my labors. But I do have confidence in the trajectory of the United States, and I do believe that as Attorney General, and as I assemble what I think is going to be the best team of young lawyers in the country, and frankly, we also have a program called Project Encore, where we're soliciting lawyers who are retired, because there are a lot of folks with a lot of wherewithal. So we have a lot of the best lawyers in America who have been sort of nudged out early by their law firms, and we're trying to get them back reengaged. So I'm going to have the best multi-generational team of lawyers, let me say, to advance causes that may take some time. But if we do our work, I think we can restore integrity to our electoral process. I think if we do our work, some future court will overturn the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United and establish the real meaning of one person, one vote, instead of $1, one vote. I think if we do our... Thank you. If we do our work... I think we will establish eventually that the right to a sound basic education is not just a New York State constitutional quirk. It's a matter of equal protection of the laws. I don't think we can be a nation that guarantees success, but we have to guarantee that every kid has a fair shot in life, and that cannot be done if we don't have good schools in every community. And if we do our work, we will, over the next few decades, transform a criminal justice system that is as wasteful and harmful and as much of a barrier to public safety as you can imagine. And I've worked in criminal justice since I was a deputy sheriff back in the 1970s. We will transform that. We will end this failed experiment in mass incarceration that is costing us so much money and destroying so many communities. You don't need to have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners, which is what we have today. But all of these efforts require a commitment to long-term change, require a commitment to raising public consciousness, to being strategic, and to moving things forward in the way that Charles Hamilton Houston, when no one thought you were ever going to eliminate segregation in America, took this on, wrote it down, and carried it out. So those are my three goals for the office. You can have a great law firm. We're going to make sure that to the extent we can, New York is as competitive as it can be in the global economy, and we will advance the quintessential American idea of equal justice under law and undertake projects, even if they're not things we're going to all live to see. I don't know that this country always moves forward, and I may not personally get to see all this stuff. I may not get there, but I know that we will get there. So thank you very much, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you. I do have a few questions here that were thought out in advance. You did talk about the importance of eliminating Medicaid fraud. But we have a question here about what do you see a role for the Attorney General's office in reining in the Medicaid Inspector General's office so to focus on fraud versus errors? Do you see a difference there?
Yes. And this is something that There are negotiations going right now in the context of the budget in Albany about a lot of health care reform issues. So this is a set of issues that are very much in flux, and I'm hopeful that we will be able to close the budget down on time. I'm actually more than hopeful. I'm quite optimistic. But that means that this week is kind of the week that everything is being hashed out. The Office of the Medicaid Inspector General is really more of a regulator of the industry. Our office, we're really more the prosecutors. We go after the fraud. OMIG is more responsible for making sure the paperwork is done correctly. We do get complaints from a lot of folks who feel that, you know, sometimes they're nitpicking or looking for details. I look forward to looking into the relationship between the two agencies and to working with the new administration to try and clean this up. I think there's plenty of work for everyone to do, and I like a model where you have good regulators who understand the industry, help people do their jobs well, make sure that the records are kept properly, but then let the prosecutors actually look for misconduct and enforce the law. That works in a lot of other state agencies. That works to a great extent in the Department of Environmental Conservation, where they've had a tradition, although they're facing massive cutbacks, of identifying problems and then letting the Attorney General's and Environmental Protection Bureau take action. So that's the approach that I favor.
Could you please comment on the governor's malpractice reform proposal?
Well, that is, I said, things are in play in Albany. Some things are on fire in Albany, and that is a tremendously contentious proposal. I don't know exactly what the state of the negotiations are. It is clear that as a part of an overall reform of the healthcare system, addressing the system of medical malpractice and malpractice insurance has to be a part of the overall reform. Malpractice premiums are way too high, and there are dueling theories as to why they are too high, and as most situations where people get polarized on an issue, there's probably some truth on both sides. I think a lot more can and should be done to prevent hospital and medical errors to stop the harm in the first place. I am a big believer in someone who, as far as I talk to criminal justice audiences about this a lot, Catching a bad guy and punishing him is good. Preventing the crime from taking place in the first place is better. And getting someone out of the cycle of crime and violence and back to being a law-abiding, tax-paying citizen is the best. So same thing in terms of medical malpractice. Better to prevent malpractice. And there are there's all this empirical evidence of things that we can do. I mean, really simple stuff, just like making sure people have hand sanitizer and that the electronic maintenance of records. That's something that a lot of the folks who are in the legal community advance. On the other hand, you know, there are situations where there are some irrationalities in the current tort system, and I hope that those will be taken up. I think that the governor's proposal on this issue will come out partly intact. I think that the bigger challenge is to go forward and have a better system that is not... We do need a system in New York State where all the data doesn't just either come from the medical industry or from the tort lawyers. And so I think that part of the reform that we're seeking is something that would enable us to keep better records. I think this is an issue that, you know, believe me, this is a national issue. Everyone says, oh, you know, everyone's leaving New York because the malpractice premiums are too high. But go to, you know, I talk to my colleagues in other states. They all tell me everyone's leaving their state too, so I don't know where everyone's going. But I think this is something. Look, the governor has shown a lot of courage in his first months in office, and he's taken on issues that people in Albany have avoided for a long time. This is one of them, the issue of pensions. Do you know how easy it's been for generations of politicians to say, we'll give up on the wages, we're just going to give you pensions in 20 years, I'm going to be gone? You know, that was the Albany MO. And he's finally standing up and saying, you know, for all of our sakes, this is not anti-union, this is not Wisconsin, but we have to deal with this issue. And I think Med-Mal falls in that category.
Another issue that actually I think Governor Cuomo took up as Attorney General and you have followed through on, and it is in the news a lot, is concerns about the Indian Point nuclear plant. How is that facility different, that situation obviously different because of the nearness to New York City, but the facility itself and the concerns different than concerns with the upstate reactors?
Well, they're completely different situations. Indian Point is in the process of a relicensing an examination for relicensing. They've got a relicensing procedure. These plants have, you know, when the plans that they submit to the NRC give them a certain lifespan. Indian Point's 20 years are about to end, the two reactors that are working. 2013, which is right around the corner, is the year for that. So Indian Point is in the process of this relicensing. That's not true of the 9 Mile facility upstate. It's also true that when he was Attorney General, Governor Cuomo, and I, as Attorney General, have said to the NRC, hey, guys, there are fault lines there. Can we're not saying you have to rule, but you have to at least take into account the possibility of an earth tremor. And they refused to make that even a consideration in the relicensing process. So the fight we're in with the NRC now is really... And then some other part of the NRC came out with a report saying the plant in the United States they're most worried about of any plant is Indian Point. I was like, come on, guys. This is like you got some other part of your bureaucracy saying this is a problem. You have refused to consider this. So I wrote a letter to the head of the NRC and announced it and submitted, said you got to reform the regulations that prevent these things from being considered. And we're going back and forth with them now. The governor who is... asked them to put this Indian Point at the top of the list for inspection and review. It is different because Indian Point is on a seismic fault line. It is also different because of the tens of millions of people who live in the surrounding area around Indian Point. There is no one, I think, who, if we had it to do over again, would decide that you want to build a nuclear power plant 20 miles north of the Bronx. You know, it's just not... You know, not a great location, and that area, the suburbs and the exurbs, and the city itself, actually, the city continues to grow. There's a lot of people there. There's no evacuation plan. I mean, they've got an evacuation plan, but you guys have driven in the suburbs and during rush hour. So we're challenging them on that. It is really important, again, it is very important, and I say this as a believer in the public-private partnership that has made our state and our nation so great and so unique. I am a believer in public regulation of energy production, but people have to have confidence that the NRC is not just in the pocket of the industry and they're performing this in a legitimate way. So that's an issue that we will continue to be involved with. And there's also a certain element of trying to get the public out of its more passive mode. I've done a lot with respect to environmental protection since I've been the AG. The first case I brought was against this horrendous power plant in Homer City, Pennsylvania, that produced more pollutants that blew over into New York State than all the plants in New York State combined. I think it was about twice as much as all the plants in New York State combined. That's how dirty this place is. I can't imagine. I've not visited, but then I really am not that interested in visiting that neighborhood. But it's difficult to imagine. But I think we're going to be vigilant about this. It's important for people to have the pressure of a deadline coming up to really get them to focus on alternatives and development of alternatives. In the long run, the future of America is a green energy future. The president has said this. In the State of the Union address, he spoke about it. But sometimes you need deadlines to really force people to develop innovations and to fund innovations and to fund the research we need. There's also a lot we can do with conservation. You know, this is the unintended consequences of technological changes. All of those cable boxes, those are on all the time. TVs now suck up much more electricity than refrigerators in New York and all across America. So, you know, there's things that we can do that sound simple that actually reduce the need for electricity substantially. And I think all those issues are going to be brought to a head through this relicensing process, and that's one of the reasons that I'm keeping the pressure on. But after what happened in Japan, it is beyond absurd that they still have regulations that say possible seismic problems are not a part of to be factored in the relicensing process. So that's the issue that I've been fighting with them on.
Thank you. One of the things that we all have in common is that we are all consumers. Can you talk a little bit about what the Office of the Attorney General's activities are in the area of consumer protection?
Sure. That has been one of the core functions of the office, really, since Robert Abrams really built the consumer protection function of the office up into what it is today. We have already initiated a whole variety of proceedings taken action and sued people and settled cases in connection with consumer fraud. One of the things that is, as I think I mentioned earlier, a particular concern to people across the state are things that have to do with debt. Everything's about debt being abused by your credit card company, people who propose to reconstitute your debt and somehow turn lead into gold. Mortgage scams continue, and mortgage refinancing scams continue to abound. That's a huge area of importance for consumers. Interestingly enough, we just released our survey during Consumer Protection Week of all of the complaints our offices have received. Far and away, the top complaints related to internet fraud. And we're prepared to develop some substantial resources to this, and we're actually reaching out to people in the industry to help us with innovation and to help us with funding for some of these ideas. You know, some years ago, a decade or so ago, the Attorney General's office decided, well, you know what? The Internet, that's a new thing. We've got to have an Internet Fraud Bureau. Now, every bureau is an Internet Fraud Bureau. There is nothing that happened. The Internet is the crime scene of the 21st century. And my office shut down this very complicated cigarette shipping tax evasion scheme being run by people who were all in Eastern Europe through the Internet, where they were delivering millions and millions of cigarettes into New York State, evading tax laws, and it was all done through the Internet. People's identity theft problems, people getting a hold of your credit card number, this is the number one area that consumers are bringing to us right now, and it's something, look, I'm as guilty as all the rest of you. When I have a problem online, I call my teenage daughter. I mean, I'm not purport to be an expert in this area, but the fact that, you know, I'm that confused, what does that say about the average New Yorker who's just sort of trying to get by and sees what seems to be a good deal online with what appears to be a legitimate business? So we've been trying to publicize the ways you can tell if there are scams. We're doing that on our website. And we are going to be making an investment in this. This is something that is great technology, but it's sort of like the automobile before they invented seat belts and airbags and things like that. It's a great technology, but it just needs to have the protections in place that people need.
A little bit of a specialized question here. We're very fond of our cultural institutions, and with the challenging economy, cultural institutions like museums, there's increasing pressure on some to sell portions of their collections. There may be some restrictions and controls on this, but there's also some public concern and criticism over moves to sell off collections. Can you tell us whether or not in New York State the Attorney General's office has some degree of responsibility to police this process and how it works in your office? Have you come across this issue?
We have. Is this a historian or a curator in the audience who probably is interested in this? Good. I have a question. Why are you historians so obsessed with the past? Just kidding. No, this is a substantial problem, and it is, again, a problem that arises more often in hard economic times. We have a lot of great cultural institutions in New York, and we went through this with the New York Historical Society. That was a great group that had this incredible collection, but was broke and had to sell off part of its collection to survive. Our office does have a role in reviewing those sorts of activities just to make sure that the purpose of the institution is not being violated by short-term effort just to raise funds immediately. Having said that, I think that, you know, institutions have to have the ability to survive, and we try and help people with mergers and help people undertake legitimate efforts. If you're not selling off a substantial part of the collection, there really isn't that much of a restriction on folks right now. Our office gets involved when it becomes substantial. And we're all just going to have to pull together on this. I mean, this is just something that it is very tough. And when the budget comes out, you know, we'll be fighting about some of the details. There are some things that are very minor items in the budget. And certainly all cultural affairs, whether they're museums or galleries or collections or performing arts or anything, any other community art programs, it's a minuscule part of the budget. But it is such an important part of the lives of New Yorkers. I've served on and was very proud to work with the folks who set up a couple of years ago, for the first time in the history of the New York State Senate, we set up a committee on the arts and really focusing on the economic development aspects of the arts in New York. Certainly down in the part of the state I come from, it is just incredible the energy, the vitality, the economic growth that the arts bring to our state. So our Charities Bureau does intervene and have to supervise some of these matters where a museum has to sell off a collection. Very often these institutions have their own internal documents and covenants that are more of an impediment than the state law. But it's something that we are looking at, we're cognizant of, and I'm a big supporter of the arts, and look forward to working with folks in that community to get through these hard times and then to secure better long-term sources of funding for something that is just not just a great economic vehicle, but something that really does make our state unique in the world. There is nothing like the art scene in the state of New York anywhere in the world.
I have one last question here, and then we may have time for one or two from the audience. One of the issues that we have, certainly with crime here, is there is a lot of drug-related crime. And I wondered if you could talk about anything that the Attorney General's office is doing in that area.
Sure. We 2 weeks ago, our organized crime task force, working with local law enforcement, shut down the largest heroin ring in the history of Western New York, out in Buffalo, and took something like $4 million worth of heroin off the streets. So, as I said earlier, the traditional law enforcement approach has to be maintained. You know, if bad guys are doing bad things, you got to catch them. But it is also much more important to put more resources into preventing crime. And I've worked in the criminal justice field since 1977. And when I first started, we didn't know much about anything. When I was a deputy sheriff in the jail, there we were just experimenting with things. We didn't have a lot of data on things that had worked. Also important to note, At that time, in all of the United States, we probably had 300,000 to 400,000 people in all of our prisons and jails. We now have 2.4 million people in all of our prisons and jails. So we didn't know a lot then, and then we started on this program of mass incarceration that is very easy to understand politically. It's always, your political consultant always tells you it's safer to vote to get tough on crime. You vote for longer sentences. You vote for three strikes, you're outlaws. Next thing you wake up, and you've got what we have today, which is a situation in which about 700,000 people are dumped out of America's prisons into poor communities every year with virtually no job prospects, with very little reentry service, and it's just not working. So we now have had all these decades to study this. And a few years ago, I sat on the New York State Sentencing Commission that then Governor Spitzer set up for about 18 months. Great commission, defense lawyers, prosecutors, judges, advocates, correctional experts. And I discovered that we know a lot about how to prevent crime, but also a lot about how to get people out of this cycle. And we're not necessarily spending money on it, because we're spending all our money maintaining the high-security prisons where the 2.4 million people are. But what's called evidence-based practices are very real. This is not some fuzzy-headed liberal thinking. This is how you reduce crime, how you make us safer by using the best practices. And we have examples in New York State that have worked tremendously. The district attorney in Kings County started the first major set of drug courts. We have judges with particular expertise and access to medical experts. So you can make a distinction. And very often, the experts tell us it's really easy to tell the difference between someone who's an addict who steals to support their habit and someone who really is a gangster who just likes to get high. There are cognitive behavioral therapies that work with folks who just really do have anger management problems. Probably two-thirds of the people in America's criminal justice system right now have some psychological or mental problem that is a serious contributor to their conduct. So I think we have to increase our police activities. Oh, and I forgot to mention the second part of it. Preventing crime. Programs like the CompStat program, where we keep statistics on where crimes take place and deploy the police in a systematic way, not just a random way or according to anecdotal evidence. The use of red light cameras, incredible tool for crime prevention. I mean, when I chaired the committee to expel Senator Monserrat, which was a tremendous political challenge, believe me, the leaders in both political parties cautioned me, like this. They said, where do you draw the line? If you start, throwing people out for this kind of a misdemeanor, then you might have to throw other people out, to which my answer was, yes. we had a video of him assaulting his girlfriend, his partner, and that's something that, investment in prevention materials, investment in tracking data, tremendously important. That was actually a big part of the heroin ring we busted in Western New York. The product and the money were flowing up from the Bronx to Western New York, and we were able, in a really great display of cooperation among competing agencies, that everyone working together seamlessly, everything was kept quiet. We even got the Federal Border Patrol to come in and bring us translators when we needed them. So prevention, we can do a lot more. Programs to break people out of the cycle of crime and violence, we can do a lot more. And in the meantime, we have to maintain our vigilance. And I view this as another matter of equal justice under law. You should be safe in your home and on your street no matter how poor your community is. That's something that the state should commit to every one of its citizens, and that's something I believe in very strongly.
A question that someone didn't have a chance to write down.
Oh, thank you. Every time I hear a conversation about sort of thinking about the future, the long-term future of our region, it always ends with somebody bringing up the two words, home rule. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the whole concept of home rule. And I haven't ever heard anything good about it, but I'm wondering, is there a way to transcend that so we can have a kind of a vision of the long-term good of a whole region of the state?
I don't know who you're talking to. I have lots of conversations where they never talk about home rule. I think, look, we're this is something that, and this is a good thing to close on. My first involvement in politics was when I volunteered in 1982 on the campaign of a a three-time loser running for governor who's going down for the fourth time, who was named Mario Cuomo, who was 40 points behind in the polls in June. And there were about eight of us there. One of them was the guy who's just been elected governor. And one of the things that he's focused on as AG and as governor is the structural dysfunctionality of the laws in New York. We have all of these different taxing jurisdictions. We have more taxing jurisdictions far and away than any other state. And it's not just a matter of the problem between statewide policies and home rule issues. It's that overlapping jurisdictions undercut each other all the time. So I think that the budget is the first step, but I think you can look forward to us taking a harder look at the overall structure of the delivery of services in New York City. This is one of the reasons I'm so adamant that the lawyers in my office pursue fraud against local governments under the False Claims Act. All these little tiny taxing jurisdictions, overlapping town, village, county, city. In Long Island, they have an algae district. They have beach districts. And these all, you know, have people who work for them. We've got to deal with that structural dysfunctionality. And I think that's really going to be a focus. I think that issues related to home rule have always been with us and always will be with us. It's, you know, you want the balance of statewide policy that's for the collective common good and people in a community having the ability to control what happens to them. Our current structure is not working, and our current structure has just bred more and more gridlock and conflicts. And one thing I know, the people in every corner of this state, rich, poor, rural, urban, black, white, Latino, Asian, they are sick of gridlock in the functioning of our state government, and I do think you can expect to see those laws get a very hard look and undergo some changes in the course of the next years.
Thank you. Thank you for all.
Thank you.